This podcast is brought to you by Purposefully Different Productions and is proudly sponsored by Little Dish, makers of delicious fresh meals for kids that are an absolute lifesaver on busy days. I love these meals because they are different to other kids' meals out there. They include a variety of ingredients, lots of textures, and are made with little taste buds in mind. Before we get started on today's episode, here's a word from our friend Giovanna Fletcher.
At Little Dish, we've spent years perfecting delicious, healthy, fresh meals guaranteed to be eaten by kids. Except when you sprinkle cheese on top instead of letting them do it, or if the Little Dish is served on the red plate or the yellow plate or the blue plate, or when you talk over them, or when they can't wear their Ranger antlers because it's summer and they're in the loft, or on Mondays or on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays, and potentially even Sundays. Good luck and Godspeed. Little Dish. Healthy food kids love. Find us in the chilled aisle.
Hello and welcome back to How to Feed with me, Charlotte Sterling-Reed, the parenting podcast that brings you reassurance, confidence and practical advice on feeding your baby, toddler and your whole family. Today's episode is a fascinating one. I'm joined by the brilliant Dr. Giles Yeo, geneticist, author and all-round expert on the science of what makes us eat the way we do. We're diving into a topic that so many parents ask me about. How much of our children's appetite, food preferences, and eating behaviours are shaped by their genetics? And how much of it is down to the environment we create at home? Can your baby be born a fussy eater? Or are some kids just naturally more hungry than others? And what does the science really tell us about the balance between nature and nurture when it comes to food? If you've ever wondered why your siblings have completely different eating habits or felt really frustrated trying to help your child eat well despite your best efforts, this episode honestly is for you. Giles, thank you so much for coming. I'm really, really thrilled that you're here on the sofa next to me to talk today.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, you have a fantastic job, but it's very complicated. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do? I think it's complicated anyway.
No, it is. Actually, it's ridiculously complicated, but not. So my title, for whatever reason, it's a long story. My title is the professor of molecular neuroendocrinology. And it's one of these things where you can only have one professor of one type at Cambridge, so you got to pick something. So at the end, all the easy ones have been taken. Biology, genetics, all taken. So molecular, we understand, small bits. Neuro, we understand. Endocrinology is the study of hormones. So actually, if you put all that together, I study how hormones south of the neck communicate with the brain at the molecular level. That's my
Brilliant.
Day job.
That's a very simplified version, right. And I like it. Because that is quite a title, isn't it?
It is. But that's because it's like Yoda, right? So that by the time you actually move all the words around, that was the only professorship left available
left.
For me.
No, I love it. Yeah. Well, it's perfect. So first of all, I work with parents a lot. Mm-hmm. And in my experience, parents really struggle when it comes to feeding kids with two things. One is kind of getting them to eat in the first place, that learning about how to eat. Mm-hmm. And number two is around how much children should be eating. So I definitely want to talk about these two things. But with that all in mind, what do you, in your experience, with regard to children's eating habit, is likely to be genetic versus learned? So big question, but children's eating habits, what's genetic? How much of it is learned?
It's going to be, roughly speaking, half and half. I'll give you an example. So my wife and I, okay, just give you an example. So my wife's English, and we both are carb lovers, okay? However, the way that we consume our carbs are completely different. So my wife likes it in the form of bread and pastry. I can take or leave bread. Whereas without backing myself into a stereotype, I like rice and noodles, okay? Both carby. But now, clearly, that element, the fact that I eat rice and I eat noodles versus bread for my wife, that is taught. It's cultural. So culture is taught. The love of carbs, however, is going to be genetic.
Okay.
Right? Because that's not a taught thing. It's not, no one's going to be shoving bread in your mouth saying that, right? And so what you like in terms of specific tastes and nutrients are far more likely to be genetic, whereas how it appears, what you eat, do you like it hot or cold, do you like it, whatever, that is more likely to be learned.
That's so fascinating.
And that's going to happen in childhood.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. And I think genuinely it's, you know, it's such a complicated thing feeding kids. And also, obviously, we're in a world at the moment where the information that you see online is so complicated and so confusing. So for me, I think anything where we can distill some of this information to parents and help them realize that a lot of this is outside of your control, would you say that's accurate?
I think a lot of it is outside your control. Even though it's outside your control, though, I think, and presumably we'll get to that, don't make a big deal out of it. And I think ultimately that's going to be the thing. You got to embrace the noise and embrace what it is. And at the end of the day, actually, we've evolved to a situation now where all of us sort of kind of know when and where and how much to eat, and we're alive to have this conversation. I think the same is going to be true for your children as well.
Yes.
We need to be careful about certain things, mm-hmm. but broadly speaking, mm-hmm. it's okay.
Yeah, okay. And I talk a lot about introducing solid foods. And I talk a lot about the kind of innate preferences, especially during weaning. There is research that looks at, you know, babies in the womb who have innate preferences that can be shown for sweet over, say, bitter flavors. How much do you think genetics plays a role in that? You know, whether a child is likely to love sweet food or whether they are likely to accept more savory?
Okay, there's a complex question. So I think first, if we deal with the average biology of the average mammal, actually, doesn't deal with humans. And so I attended a meeting, the Society for the Study of Ingestive Behavior, SIB, as they call it. I'm not a behavioral person, but I was there. And I remember, this was probably about 10, 15 years ago. And I remembered someone who does behavioral, sort of comparative behavior in babies, okay, across all mammals. And what they showed was when you just, either a newborn baby or a newborn monkey, a newborn mouse, newborn whatever that is mammal, and you actually put something, not bitter as in disgusting, bitter as in what you and I would love, all of them made the face.
Yes.
Okay. And this is like seriously, like before you learn a thing. Okay. Whereas the moment you put something sweet, and this is so sweet that we feel our pancreas resolved mm-hmm. as an adult, and all their face, they have this
yeah.
sort of paradise look in their face. The love of sugar yeah. is ingrained and hardwired the moment you come up. Because what's the purpose of a baby mammal? The purpose of a baby mammal is, first of all, to latch on to the first source of food, okay, that's available, and to grow quickly to yeah. stop becoming tiger food. So what they do is they latch on to sugar, largely, which is found in milk, and the love of sugar is innately hardwired. And then something happens as you go through puberty where suddenly that switches, your palate matures. Okay, so that's the average. Underneath it all, there are then genes that actually play a role. So we do know genes, for example, just single genes, that make someone more or less likely to, not to like, but to taste the bitterness in certain foods. These are the so-called super tasters, all right? Just one little gene. And what happens is, with this one single change, which 50% of the people have, I want to point
okay.
out, right? So this,
yep.
is, this is not rare. Some people will take, and you can take the purified chemical. I did a talk actually at the Royal Institution where mm-hmm. we did this exact demonstration.
Mm.
Okay, where we took, and we did it in kids.
From the audience.
From
oh,
the
okay,
audience,
got
from
you.
The
yeah,
audience,
yeah,
from
yeah
the
I saw
audience.
It.
And
yeah.
what we did was we took 10 kids out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so on average, half of them would have this. And what we had done was we put little pieces of paper and put a dot of this bitterness. This is the bitterness that is normally found in a brassica. So in
okay, yeah.
Broccoli and
dark
Brussels sprouts.
Dark green leafy
exactly.
veg, yeah.
Exactly. And so what we then had them do was to all put it on their tongue. Now, I know I can taste it. Okay, I know I can taste it. And so, and I'd already done it, so I know what it tastes like. But the kids didn't know what was going on, right? And so, and these are kids. And so they put it in their mouth and suddenly they were going, bah, bah, bah. Like half of them were doing that.
Yeah.
Whereas the other half were going, these yeah. kids are what? And so, and that's because of their genes. Now, it doesn't mean that if you have this super taster gene that you don't like Brussels sprouts, for example. But if you don't tend to like bitter foods and you have that gene, the likelihood of you liking Brussels sprouts is very low.
Okay.
So there's that kind of, mm-hmm. Those kind of genes
okay.
as well that are going to be underneath there. Definitely influencing the teaching and the hardwiring that is there in normal biology.
So it's innate, and because it makes sense environmentally for children to enjoy sugar, for example, but there is also a genetic element to it as well, because that's adding quite a lot of complications, isn't there, to to feeding kids. If you've got this kind of preference for sweet foods and then half of the children are more likely to be super tasters and have this kind of element, that does make parents' job quite challenging.
That makes the parents' job quite challenging,
yeah.
And that's only one of the genes.
Yes,
right?
Okay.
So then you put in, there are going to be genes that involve in some kids preferring fatty food to sweet food, and all of the things behind it. So a lot of it is going to be learned, undoubtedly. All right. And I think the family environment is obviously where you make that learning. But a lot of it is going to be of genetics. And as one of these, you just have to, well, I don't know. No one is genetically testing on your kids. So how do you know? And so this is why you just have to sort of just you got to go and see what your kids like or do not like. And at some point, it will be quite clear that actually, it doesn't really matter how you threaten them. Don't do that. But you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're not going to like this.
Okay.
And so I'm sure there are other healthy foods.
Because I talk an awful lot as well about familiarization. In fact, I've got a whole episode about familiarization because there's a lot of research that shows that actually kids like what they're familiar with. And there's also that element of, you know, how we kind of grow to like things like red wine and olives and dark chocolate that maybe we wouldn't have liked when we were younger. So I think what I'm trying to get at is how can parents know, okay, they definitely don't like this food? Or do you think that even if their genetics maybe makes them less likely to accept flavors, can they still learn to like it? Can they still become familiarized? You know, we talk about 10 to 15 tastes before foods can be accepted. So can that work even if your genetics predisposes you to not accept that flavor? Can they still learn to like it?
It depends on what the flavor is. I think, and it's a spectrum. I think the answer is never going to be never. I just said never, but it's never going to be never.
Never going to be never.
And so I think ultimately, because there are other genes involved. There are genes in which I don't like bitterness, but then there may be other genes which make you more willing to accept differences.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
So there's a complex underlying. So let me give you another example, all right? There's another single gene which makes some people hate coriander, the herb, rather than
I don't like coriander. There you go.
It makes it taste like soap.
Yes, I do not like it on any food.
Yeah, so this is not some taste thing. It's not because you're not well brought up. Once again, single gene, which because of a biochemical process makes it taste like soap. Who the hell likes soap? No one likes soap. And it doesn't matter what I throw, you're not going to like it. I mean, you may eat it, but you're not going to love it.
Yeah.
And and so there are going to be a whole host of foods like that are actually out there, which are going to be impossible to. Now, the bitterness thing is slightly different, right? Because most kids don't like bitter foods because they're hardwired to go for the high, for two things. Bitter tends to be poisonous. In the red berry, blueberry lion world, tends to be poisonous, and sweet is highly energetic. And so as a child or as a baby mammal, that's what you're hardwired to do. Then as you grow up, we learn that actually, and then we go and, oh, here's coriander, here's rosemary, whatever. And we like what we like, and we like beer and things. And so there is then the segment where the moment you get past the helpless mammal scenario, you then begin to actually, your palate does actually mature, for lack of a better term. And some people's palates take longer to mature than others. Some people's palates never mature.
Absolutely. Yeah, okay. Exactly.
And I think there are also a lot of genes that actually underlie that. And we understand less of it than we would like.
Yes, of course.
But undoubtedly, there are genes that undoubtedly there are things that are out of your control.
So basically, as well, you know, kind of with parents, it's sort of keep trying. You know, it doesn't mean that if your child doesn't like something, they won't ever, but there might be some foods that they just don't like me with coriander. I just don't like it. I don't want it on any foods. Even if I kind of was offered it 20 times, I probably still wouldn't like it.
You wouldn't because it would taste like soap. So
yeah,
until you like soap, you're not going to do it. And so I think the way to do it would be just to keep offering variety, and actually you'll begin to find out that they don't dislike all vegetables. They only dislike certain vegetables. If that's the case, well, come on, why are you starting a fight in your kitchen?
Exactly. So there's so much variety.
Then find the stuff that they like to eat, and then sort of maybe Trojan horse some of it in and see whether or not they will notice
it
later.
I love it. And the relaxed approach is just the best. Variety and relaxing about it is two huge lessons for parents. So I love that you've said that yourself.
Yeah. I'm teaching grandma how to suck eggs, with all respect to grandmas. But you know, children pick up. They pick up when they're being bad or being forced to like something.
So the biggest question, and this you kind of answered this one, but a really big question is, what about fussy eating? Is it genetic?
There was just a recent paper which shows that there is going to be genetic basis to fussy eating. And I'm not surprised. I mean, the reality is there's genetics underlying all human traits and behaviors. It's just to what degree. And it's to what degree the environment either the parental environment, the home environment, or socioeconomic environment. It's to what degree that plays a role. So no, I do think that fussy eating has a genetic component. I do think with the it's very difficult to pull it apart, right? Because fuss, if it's genetic, then the parents are also going to be tend to be fussy.
Yeah, okay.
Which
yeah.
means that the parents might be fussy.
Impacts the environment, yeah.
Fussy, yeah. You know. And if you... If you have a little, you know, child growing up in a seriously fussy environment where they worry about everything, then the likelihood of you learning those behaviors plus the genes are going to be there. But no, undoubtedly there's going to be genetics in fussy eating.
But also, genes do predispose you to something. They don't mean, you know, because I always try and talk about this. You're and correct me if I'm wrong, but I always talk about the fact that your genes might predispose you, but it doesn't equal your complete fate. There are still some things you can do to change. You know, if you are born to be more fussy, it doesn't mean that you can't learn to accept a wide variety of foods, right? You can still make adaptations to that. Is that correct?
The analogy that I would use is I will never run as fast as Usain Bolt. Yeah. Okay, and that is because of my genes. I'm sticking to it. But it doesn't mean that if I train, I won't run faster than I do
exactly.
now.
Exactly.
So ultimately, that's it, right? Where I will never be an Olympic athlete. Most of us here will never be Olympic athletes. Most of us here will never be Olympic athletes. But mm-hmm. we train, we go, whatever we do, and we get better at doing that.
Exactly.
Very few of us maximize our genetic potential. Probably the only time we maximize our genetic potential, like professional athletes do, I think I maximize my certain genetic potential because of my work. That's probably when you maximize your genetic potential within your work.
Within
element.
Your work, yeah.
Because otherwise you're standing sat there, you're going, you know, I'm not, you know, and I'm not really maximizing my fitness because I've got to work. So that, I think that's the answer, where there is a genetic, there are going to be genetic possibilities, but that is not as narrow as you might think. And you can almost always, aside from things like coriander, okay, you can almost always learn something or unlearn something within a certain set of parameters.
Yes, I love it. I think that's so important for parents to know and still have that, you know, idea of that's not the end. It doesn't mean that just because your child is really fussy or you feel like maybe their genetics is one way, it doesn't mean there's nothing you can do. And right. I love that. I think it's really important to get that message out. So I want to talk to you about responsive feeding, because again, this is more to do with like how much children eat. I talk a lot about responsive feeding, which is essentially we set up the kind of parameters, we offer the food at a regular time, we're in charge of what's on offer, but we allow the child to decide and dictate how much they're going to eat, and we respond to their cues at mealtime. So it's something I talk about a lot, rather than it being like, this is the food, you're going to eat it. And you know, I grew up in the time where it was like, well, you must eat half your plate, have three more spoonfuls or you can't get down. Whereas now we talk so much more about, it's up to you how much. And I talk about a bi-directional communication at mealtime. So child says they don't want more, we listen to that cue, we respond in an appropriate way, the child learns, that's how my mum's going to respond when I respond in this way. So
if I might ask mm-hmm. how old are we talking, because I first of all, this is the first time I've heard the term.
Okay.
How old are we talking about when you're giving this advice?
Right from the start. So the idea of responsive feeding is when we are weaning a baby, for example, we put the food down, and again, go back 10-20 years, it used to be a case of we would just keep feeding the baby until the plate was finished. But whereas now we talk about, let's look at baby signs and signals. Are they clamping their mouth shut? Are they pushing the food away? Are they saying they don't want more? Because that is them responding, my appetite is done, I'm not hungry anymore, I don't want this food. And it might be for a variety of reasons. So I talk loads about that communication around mealtimes, listening to their own appetite. Do you have any thoughts around appetite with young children? Because, you know, I'm a strong believer in that. You know, we don't know how much children need. You can't possibly predict how much a single child needs. But is there a lot of differences in appetite? And do you kind of agree with that concept of responsive feeding?
So appetite, I do, except in certain rare cases.
Yes.
I'll come down in a second. So the term appetite, I always find very interesting. It's a complex term because it's an integrated term, which I like to think encompasses broadly three different type of concepts. It encompasses, it's like a triangle, appetite in the middle. It encompasses hunger, and that's the part of the brain that's taken care of by the hypothalamus, base of the brain. It encompasses how full or how quickly full you get, different part of the brain here, and different from hunger. different circuits, and how nice you feel when you eat. And that tends to be up the reward elements. And it's this triangle. Appetite sits in the middle. Some people are tugged more towards the hunger. Some people need more food to get filled up. Some people need more chocolate in order to hit the niceness.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right? Okay.
And this is inbuilt into us. Okay. And so this shape of the triangle, sort of the same area, but this actually changes. So appetite has huge genetic underpinnings. I'm not saying there's no learned stuff, but a high appetite drive is highly likely to be very powerfully genetic rather than learned. So some kids will always find it more difficult to say no to food than others. Now, we study, where I am in Cambridge, we study the genetics of severe childhood obesity. I mean, we study normal body weight, but the genetics of severe childhood obesity. Just to be clear what severe childhood obesity is, this is 99.99 centile. So these are 3-4-year-olds who mm-hmm. are 100 pounds. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm not talking regular.
Yeah, yeah.
But then we look at onset of obesity before the age of 10, but actually mm-hmm. the vast majority are before the age of 5.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the reason we pick that, particularly that early cutoff, mm-hmm. is, as you said, normally, mm-hmm. under normal circumstances, children will stop eating when they're full.
Yep.
Unless there's something genetically, unless a circuit has been broken.
Okay.
And we have found that if you concentrate on that area of mm-hmm. severe obesity before the age of 5, maybe 10, then we enrich for these real severe, really rare mutations in order to actually understand pathways.
Mm-hmm.
In that situation,
yep.
that's a very difficult situation. But it's super rare.
Yeah, yeah.
It's super rare.
But what would you do in that situation? So how can you help that? Because obviously, as you said, there's almost like a pathway missing. So how do you help these children to feel full or to learn that? Can you?
It depends on what the problem is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were talking before we started recording about the fact that actually, and like I said, they're super rare, but mm-hmm. they're out there, where we have had parents with kids that are so clearly mm-hmm. have a genetic issue, mm-hmm. right? Rather mm-hmm. than anything else, but yet have the kids removed from them by social services, you know, for child abuse.
Yeah.
Because of a misunderstanding, a tragic misunderstanding
Absolutely,
of what's happening. Look, I think in these circumstances, there is very little you can do without medical support,
okay.
either from a geneticist clinician. And mm-hmm. now it really depends on where the mutation is and what mm-hmm, pathway mm-hmm. it is. There are certain pathways. So just briefly, your brain needs to understand two pieces of information, internal information, all right, in order to influence your food intake, no matter how large you are or small you are. It needs to know how much fat you have, because that is how long you would last without food.
Okay.
Okay, so that's long-term energy. You need to know that.
Mm-hmm.
And it needs to know what you're currently eating and mm-hmm. what you just ate.
Mm-hmm.
And these are signals that are going to come from your gut.
Yeah.
Okay, your gut, your stomach, and your gut. And all of these are hormonal.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is your brain senses these long and short-term hormones, and then sort of figures out, well, he has 2 kilos of fat and ate 300 calories last night. So therefore, you should be hungry, okay? And so they eat. And it integrates that signal. If you have a mutation within the fat-sensing part of the brain, those tend to result in severe, severe obesity. But there are now drugs that specifically target that fat-sensing part of the brain. And so those kids can get, very rare, but those kids can get those type of drugs
that
get that, there is nothing the parent can do without any kind of support.
Okay. And that's really good for parents to know as well, I think. But like you're saying, this is very rare. How rare are we talking, do you think? I mean, I know it's a big question, but...
No. So I think we do know. Mm. So, I mean, there are... In the whole pathway, there are some that are rarer than others.
Mm-hmm.
On average, however, if you actually take the entire pathway, this fat-sensing pathway, we have found that 0.3%, so 1 in 300 of the population, of the species, we think, okay, will have mutations in this pathway. Now, if you then, however, then enrich for it, so in other words, if you end up with if you run an obesity clinic, or you run a situation in which you're a dietitian, nutritionist, in which you're seeing kids with issues with eating, that can rise up to 10%.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it's rare, but not that rare, actually.
Yeah.
So within the cohort in which you are concerned about, it is a significant percentage. Within the broader population, 1 in 300 will have a mutation in there. So no, 99.7% of us will not have that problem.
And in terms of, so one thing, because obviously, like I mentioned about responsive feeding, it's something that many of us practice in, you know, with the general population. Mm-hmm. My two kids eat so differently. My son has such big appetite. I mean, he will eat really big meals. He'll carry, I mean, the other day, you literally gave him three portions of spaghetti with a load of veggies. I couldn't believe it. I mean, he's obviously growing, etc. But even from day one, his portions have been huge. Mm-hmm. My daughter is a bird. She will want small and often. And it's just been so fascinating to me as, you know, someone who works in this field to see when I was feeding her initially, I was, you know, giving her the same portions as him and thinking, why is she not eating this? But they are so different.
Can I be rude? Can I be rude? Please. and ask a question? What is your husband, partner, like in terms of eating and body shape and size? I'm sorry,
he's
I'm not minding my own business.
No. He's got big appetite, very athletic, very sporty. So, you know.
But huge appetite.
Big appetite as well. He eats big portions, yeah.
And where do you sit on the spectrum?
Do you know, like, I think I am definitely a smaller appetite, but obviously it changes over time. I eat a lot as well, but definitely I don't need very much to fill me up and I can get filled up quite quickly. Whereas, yeah, my husband will just keep going. Is that the answer?
No, I was just wondering, because it's sort of like, in very many ways, it's like Mr. Potato Head. Mm-hmm. I find myself sometimes at whatever, Stansted Airport at the 5 a.m. flight to Mallorca or something. Mm. And you're there with your 2 liters of Starbucks coffee. And then you see, and I love to people watch. I mind my own business. I don't open my mouth. But yeah. As a geneticist, I like to people watch. And you see families, summer vacation families that go by. And what you can see, so I don't know, because obviously they're just wandering by. So you don't know what their eating is like. But you can see their body shape.
Yeah.
Body shape. Mm-hmm. Powerfully genetically mm-hmm. influenced. Very, okay. Yeah. Very, very, very little you can do about changing your shape.
Okay.
Don't you booty bust all you want. Yeah. It's not going to change anything.
Yeah.
And so it's always very interesting for me to see, oh, look, does the daughter look like the mother or the father? And body shape is very, very powerfully, mm-hmm. I'm thinking. But
actually,
appetite probably is as well.
Too. Okay. Yeah. So you think that with my kids, they just got genetic, you know, my daughter eats little amount. That's her genetics. My son eats a lot. It's not to do with sex?
No, sex does play a role.
Okay.
Okay. But at key points, before the age, pre-puberty, they're very androgynous.
Okay.
Okay. Pre-puberty, there's no big difference. Mm-hmm. Puberty, bang.
Yeah.
You will see big differences then.
Okay.
Then obviously then as women, look, men are very boring people. We get born, we think about one thing, the other thing, and we die. So it's nothing much happens to men. Women obviously go through life.
Lots of hormone changes.
And the, you know, so first of all, there's obviously puberty. Mm-hmm. There is, if you choose to be, then there's the pre-pregnant woman, like mm-hmm. never been pregnant woman before. Yep. And if you choose to have a child, the pregnant woman, mm-hmm. who's a completely different species, because you got to keep a parasite.
Yep.
I have a child, alive. By the way. Yeah, parasite alive for 9 months. So then you have that. And then post-pregnancy, some women snap back like rubber bands, right? Whereas other women don't give up the baby weight.
Yeah.
And then post-menopause. And at which point, all of those are marked by enormous hormonal changes. And then you begin to see differences in behavior. Why do some women lose the baby weight and some don't? How come some women, when they hit the menopause, they change shape severely? Mm. So in early childhood, the sex differences are very minimal.
Okay.
Post puberty, you begin to see sex differences, yes.
Okay. And in with, you know, my two children, if for other families who maybe have a similar situation, first of all, do you think that you should let them eat to, you know, would you encourage in the normal population to let them eat to appetite? So my son who has the three portions and my daughter, that's okay, right? It's okay to have those genetic differences, the appetite differences. We shouldn't be trying to get you know, someone to eat more or less, for example.
No. I mean, I think clearly there are rare conditions in which the moment you are looking at disordered eating, this is very different. This is not the conversation we're having, right? But no, I think you should let the kids do what they do. That being said,
caveat.
I think as kids, that being the situation, but it is still a relatively controlled environment, because ultimately, whoever puts the meal on the table there's still a finite amount of food that one has put on the table. Some people serve it in big pots. Other people serve it like MasterChef and there's food in front of you. Whatever you do in your house. And so there's only a limit to which you can get to. I'll just give you an example from my son.
Yeah.
He's 24 now, incidentally.
Yeah, okay.
And I won't use his name and he will never watch this, so that's fine. So my son, I love my food. Mm-hmm. I love my food. But I also love to exercise, okay? So I'm not a skinny person, but I love to exercise. My son loves his food, but hates to exercise.
Okay.
Herein lies the beginning of the story. So look, as a child, he always loved his food, but he ate what I gave him and what have you. Oh my God, he went to uni, okay? And we hear about the freshers, 14 freshers.
I think he
had the freshers, well, at least the freshers and uni. He gained 50 pounds between 18 years old and what I ended up actually putting him on one of these new weight loss drugs beginning of the year. And he shed now 40 of those pounds. And what happened there was the reason for the freshest 15, whatever it's called. Where at home, even though you have a higher appetite, I've only cooked one chicken. Mm. You know how much can you actually eat, right? And then so what then happens was the moment, however, he then had free choice, then you actually saw what happened. So it's interesting, but I wouldn't worry too much because at the end of the day, you cook a portion size, everyone is alive, everyone is feeding. Mm. It'd be interesting when your kids get into adulthood, into uni, and then I'll report back.
We'll see.
Yeah, we'll have a follow-up.
Really fascinating because what you said, that does really show like the environment obviously does matter hugely, doesn't it, in what we're feeding. Yes. It really does play such a huge role. And just while we're on that subject, you mentioned about the weight loss drugs. Mm-hmm. I know you've talked about this a lot on podcasts and could you just really, because obviously we're not really talking about that today, but I know a lot of people listening will just want to hear your take on the weight loss drugs and what we're seeing at the moment. Because I know you speak often about them, I guess, them being misused. What's your thoughts?
Okay, so very briefly, I told you about your brain needing to know two pathways, fat and gut.
Yeah.
Okay. The weight loss drugs mimic gut hormones.
Okay.
That's what they are. They're modified version of gut hormones, so they're a natural hormone. They go up. They make you feel fuller.
Yeah.
You feel full, you eat less, you lose weight. They've been trialed in adolescents, but in young kids, they don't get the drugs.
Yeah.
I do not think they are a silver bullet for making you feel fuller. That's what they are. They'll make everyone feel fuller. But what they won't do, in other words, they'll just make you eat less of whatever the hell it is you're eating.
You are actually eating.
If you're having a healthy diet, but just having too much, fine.
Yeah.
If you're eating chips and Oreos, you'll just eat less chips and Oreos. So I think what the drugs are not a silver bullet for is improving your diet. You still need to do work on that. And you also need to exercise, obviously, to maintain muscle mass. But crucially, they're a drug, which means that if you stop the drug, the weight will come back on.
It will stop working, yeah.
So in other words, depending on how it's used, do you want to take it forever? Some people may have to. Do you want to stop? If you want to stop, the only way to keep much of the weight off is to use the opportunity while on the drug
to actually change
to change your feeding behavior.
And can people be on it forever?
These drugs are relatively new.
Yeah.
We'll have to see. I do think, however, that the large proportion of people who are on these drugs will be on these drugs for a long time in some form or other.
Yeah, okay. But obviously, because the thing that always concerned me is just, the nutrition, the actual nutrients that are being taken in. Because if you're limiting your diet and like you say, you're not eating the right things,
you can be malnourished.
How are you getting iron? How are you getting, zinc, vitamins,
And one other thing, since you have a platform, which I just want to say because it's important, these drugs are really good and useful because they're powerful and they work.
Mm-hmm.
These drugs are bad because they're powerful and they work for anyone. They work for a 300-pound man looking to lose 100 pounds. Fine. That's what they're designed for. They'll work for a 16-year-old girl who's 75 pounds. It doesn't matter what your starting weight is, they'll make you eat less. They're drugs, they should be prescribed, they should be used not as a cosmetic drug. Thought I should say that.
And, like you say, prescribed, because I think that's one of the biggest concerns.
Yes, and they're not a cosmetic tool.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Love that. Thank you for that caveat as well. So we're getting into some summaries now, because we're nearly kind of there. And honestly, this has been so fascinating. I'm so grateful. I cannot wait to listen back myself. but given what you know about genetics, what would you say for a parent is the best way to encourage variety in a toddler and child's diet? I mean, you've probably kind of answered that, but what if you there was a parent here right now, what would you be saying? How do we get variety into a child's diet?
Provide variety.
Okay.
So I think that's going to be the answer. And don't, like, really, I know it's difficult. I do know it's difficult because I'm the one who does the cooking.
Yeah.
Where you've made the meal, whatever the meal you made, yeah, and then suddenly
rejected.
Don't get too stressed about it. Maybe they really didn't like the food that you actually made them, not because you screwed it up, but because they didn't like elements of it. And so I think just don't, like, seriously, don't be offended when your kids don't like some of the things you make. It's just, and just keep providing variety. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. the moment you do that, the moment the kids know that actually at any point I might be getting different colors, different this, different mm-hmm. that on it, that's the easiest way to do it.
Love it. And that's exactly what I say. I mean, there are obviously differences. There's, you know, children with ARFRID and children with PFD, pediatric feeding disorder, which is a different kettle of fish.
Correct,
exactly.
Correct,
and
correct,
we are
correct,
talking about that on the podcast. So I've got someone coming to talk about that too. So, but that is exactly what I would say. And I love it. So can I just ask, you know, again, another couple of kind of summary questions. Based on your research, what advice would you give to ensure children grow up with healthy eating habits? I mean, I love the fact that you used your own example of where you maybe had to, you know, somewhat intervene. But how can we try and have children who like healthy food, enjoy exercise? Is there any kind of tips? And again, I know you've touched on a lot of this.
The problem, I don't think there is a shortcut to this. I really, really don't think so. I mean, we have people issues with adults with obesity, adults with disordered eating, adults with all kinds of things, and that's a different scenario. I think we have the opportunity with our children at all ages in order to teach them the best way forward. But the way to do it is to not make a big deal out of it. So always, I think two things, and I know it sounds like I sounded like a fortune cookie, but listen, two things, all right? Variety, 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 including chocolate cake, including Brussels sprouts, all right? And moderation, 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 which means that, listen, it's a birthday party. Are they gonna, it's Halloween, it's freaking Christmas, you know, are they gonna be eating too much chocolate? Yes.
Yes.
Are they eating too much chocolate every day? That's when the problem begins.
Yeah.
So I think what you want to do is those two things. Are they having a variety of so-called good and bad foods? I'm not a big fan of the term bad foods. Variety and moderation. And as long as the entire diet, okay, this is true for adults as
overall,
well.
Overall, yeah.
Overall, if matters. The diet, I always think about diets over a week.
Exactly.
Where there's weekends, there's mm-hmm. weekdays, there's all kinds of things, there's birthday parties, there's, you know. And so variety and moderation, mm-hmm. variety and mm-hmm. moderation, and mm-hmm. like, don't overthink it.
Yeah, love it. And what I've got from a lot of this conversation is the environment does really matter. So what you're doing, your role modeling, what you're offering, you know, how you're offering it, how you're responding to your child, all of that matters so much. So even though we know from what you said, genetics does have an impact, it really does, it doesn't take away from the fact that the environment in which we feed our children is still absolutely crucial. Would you agree?
I would definitely agree. I'll leave you with one, to my mind, a tragic statistic, mm-hmm. which I think always needs to be. Look, I understand the very much like the people I teach and the people that listen to me, the people that listen to you are going to be sitting within a specific socioeconomic band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I understand this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I just need to press home the point that if you actually look at the bottom quintile, the bottom 20% societally, children. Mm-hmm. Okay, if you look at primary school leaving age, so mm-hmm. looking 11-year-olds, right, leaving, that if you are in the bottom quintile, your chances of having obesity, well, let's top quintile first. People listening to this podcast, mm-hmm. top quintile, the chances of your child having obesity at the age of 11 is mm-hmm. around 15%. That's the rate. Mm-hmm. Too high. Mm-hmm. Too high.
Yeah.
If you go to the bottom quintile, 35%.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Yeah.
There is no genetic difference between rich or poor, mm-hmm. accident or birth. Mm-hmm. That is where the environment comes in, the socioeconomic environment, where schools, where, you know, are you in an inner city school with a chicken shop next door? You know, that is where the situation. So, yes, our genes and our biology is important. That's what I study.
Mm-hmm.
But do not underestimate the power of the environment and actually of socioeconomic status.
Yeah, love that. Really great. One final question. Mm-hmm. What are some of the most exciting areas of research coming up for any of the work that you're doing, not necessarily in children, but I mean, it's fascinating. Like you said, we still don't really know everything by any means, do we? The same with gut health. We do not know everything at all. What's new? What's exciting that you're kind of learning, finding? Is there anything really new that would be interesting for you to talk about?
Okay, so two things.
Yep.
One south of the neck, one north of the neck.
Okay.
We'll start with the brain. The problem is we now know the genetics of feeding behavior, all feeding behaviors always involve the brain, which means that understanding it is very difficult because we can't get into a human brain while we're still alive, okay,
yeah.
for obvious reasons. But working with, and close your ears if you're squeamish, because we work with now post-mortem samples, we're now able to map feeding circuits.
Okay. Wow. How do you do that?
So we use single-cell and spatial approaches that are now, the technology is up to the point where you're now able to actually map feeding circuits within post-mortem samples.
Wow, that's so that'd be crazy. Most
of our feeding circuit understanding have come from animals. Mm-hmm. Now, I realize mammals are mammals, and I've given you an example.
Yeah.
But we still need to understand in the
human brain.
So that's one exciting thing that's happening. The second exciting thing that's happening is actually nutrigenomics. Mm-hmm. Okay, within the field of nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
Nutrigenomics. And what I mean by that is personalized nutrition. Mm-hmm. Real personalized nutrition. Mm-hmm. Now, it's still got a long way to go, but it has really come in leaps and bounds. And primarily because of our improved technology in tracking what we eat.
Mm-hmm.
Now, even today, what should be the easiest thing to measure is actually one of the most difficult, and that is tracking what someone eats accurately at scale across the population.
Okay,
level.
Yeah.
Because you're normally dealing with these stupid
self-reported
diaries.
Data. Yeah, of course.
Whereas I think with these large language models, with these AI models, where you can now take a picture of food and suddenly knows it's
calories,
and it then extracts the average amount of nutritional tracking. The genetics is already in a spot where we can do genetics easily. The interpretation is difficult. It still costs a little bit too much money. Mm-hmm. Where we need now are the measures.
Mm-hmm.
And if we want to do real, true, personalized nutrition, do I like bitterness, fat, do I respond to a keto diet, whatever, okay? Then we need to measure what someone eats accurately.
Okay.
And we all have our godforsaken phones. I take too many pictures of my food.
Yep.
But if that can suddenly be a true food diary of tracking what you've eaten, how much you've eaten macronutriently, right, then I think the real exciting thing is now trying to understand the genetics of feeding behavior down to really quite granular levels to truly personalize our diets.
And so what you mean is we would then be able to feed back like on what kinds of things people should eat based on their genetics. So you're saying that
what kinds of people are more likely to like or dislike?
Okay.
And so therefore, and actually, look, already at the stage, we have all babies, all new babies that enter NICU, the intensive care unit, are already whole genome sequenced to rapidly find out why they're there. Okay. I think we're within a decade of having everyone sequenced the moment they pop out.
Okay.
Because then we'll get to the point where actually it's not going to be that expensive. Mm. What we do with the data, that's a discussion for a different day.
Yeah.
So with all that genetic information there, can we utilize it to do something useful, to stop the fights at the kitchen table? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you know your kid is never going to like coriander.
Yeah.
Don't freaking put it in the salad.
Yeah.
I know exactly, right?
Yeah.
And so it's a while away, but that I think is one of the most exciting things.
But what about for health? So for example, you know, what about if you are more programmed to have obesity, for example, could you then essentially tailor a diet? You could, you know, tell a parent that and tailor a diet for that, would you say?
I think so. So the moment we get better at predicting, the difficulty always is, as we've discussed, is it's not only about the genes. It's always about the environment as well.
Too.
So within whatever environment you're working, can you supply, within whatever genetics you have been born into, can you optimize the environment to optimize your health?
Exactly.
That is going to be the really, all health, right?
Yeah.
We're talking about nutrition here, but it could be obesity, it could be risk for diabetes, it could be risk for any number of different things. But ultimately, that's what certainly all us geneticists want to know.
Mm-hmm.
We are born with a set of genes that we can't do anything with.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
How can we optimize the environment to maximize
And that would be the golden ticket, right?
Yes.
For anybody.
Yes.
So yeah, that absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much. Honestly, I cannot wait to listen back. So I'm really grateful for you being here. Thank you very much, Charles.
Thank you for having me.
thank you so much for listening to this episode of How to Feed. It's so reassuring to know that while genetics do play a role in our children's appetites, there's still so much we can do as parents to support children in developing a healthy relationship with food. And that brings me perfectly onto the next episode, where I'll be diving into something really practical, which is the topic of responsive feeding. I'll be talking all about how to tune into babies' hunger and fullness cues, and how to build trust at mealtimes, as well as what signs to look out for that your baby is full. If you enjoyed today's episode, please do subscribe, share it with a friend, or leave a quick review. It really makes a big difference. And finally, a huge thank you to Little Dish, who not only support the podcast, but let us film it in their headquarters as well. This episode of How to Feed wouldn't have been possible without my sponsors, Little Dish. Their meals are fresh, delicious, and made with ingredients that you would find in your own kitchen, making them a brilliant option for busy days.